Okay. Shall we start? Any questions? How do you do? Yes, please. Okay. I was asked several times about midterm, and I'm not sure how to do this, because what I see in other courses so far is a little bit frightening for me. Because there are many technical defects in the procedure. Have you had this experience with midterm already? So I would be happy to learn a little bit more about this from you.
I had two midterms, but they were both kind of like take home.
Take home. But yeah. After that, how you submit it as a homework?
So in quantum mechanics, what he did is at the exact time the course started, he sent out a PDF with all the questions, and we had until the end of the class period to email him back our solutions. We just scanned the...
Okay.
Yeah, in other math classes, they kind of make the exams like a take home. So for one class, I have like a week to work on it. So the instructor put more questions. So we have a week, it's like a take home exam. The other one is like, he'll release that on at like 9 a.m. in the morning, and we have to email back at 5.
Mm-hmm.
So extended, yeah.
I do not really want to use lecture time for that, because we missed few lectures, and I don't want to not to be able to complete the material. So I would rather do like you suggested for the whole week. I do not like this idea. It's not an exam at all. It's not an exam for the whole day either, but at least it is something which may be sort of useful. Mm-hmm. Okay, I will try to compose this exam, and by the next week I will tell you what it will be. Probably it will be the next week. Now,
will we need to submit it in LaTeX?
Hmm?
Will we need to like write it up, PDF version? The exam?
I think so, okay. But I will try to learn. It may be done also like assessment, like your homework now, but with more limited time.
Okay.
Not for the whole week. I observe now a very unpleasant experience about it from other teachers. Okay, anyway, let's go ahead with our subject. And the last time we discussed inner product spaces with Hermitian symmetric products. And there was Gram-Schmidt process, algorithm, which we discussed last. We are now in chapter 6, and I follow it quite closely. It's very easy material. You can basically read everything. I would be happy to help you if you will have questions. And it is parallel to what we did in space without in the product. At least it will be very parallel in the next few things. Maybe in order to keep closer relation to the textbook, I will mention the places about from textbook where I which I can we consider at each moment. So anyway, a Gram-Schmidt process is the following. It produces for a basis or for any linearly independent system of vectors, a new system of vectors with which generates the same flag and which is orthonormal in the sense that the squares of vectors are one and the pairwise products besides these squares are zero, so they are orthogonal and normal. So this process works for any basis and it gives another basis. So we see immediately that any finite dimensional inner product space has orthonormal basis. This is what is formulated in the textbook as a statement 634. Any finite dimensional inner product space has an orthonormal basis. And another thing which is closely related to this is that any orthonormal least extends to orthonormal basis. So if you have some list of vectors, which is already orthonormal, then you can extend it to orthonormal basis of the whole space. And this is because of the following. You can take this as just orthonormal list. It is linearly independent. And then you complete it somehow to a basis as we did already. And then apply Gram-Schmidt. So it would improve it. Nothing will be lost. It will be still of the same, with the same properties. It will be a basis, but it will be besides orthonormal. And yeah, and this was statement 635 from the textbook. What is important here, and I want to attract your attention to this again, is that Gram-Schmidt does not make anything with the flag of space. Let me remind you that when you have some system of vectors, ordered list of vectors, the flag of this is a sequence of subspaces which starts with the span of the first one. Then you can, and this is a line, then you one dimensional space, then you can see the span of the first two vectors. It's a plane, and it contains, of course, the first one. And so on. So you add one more vector each time and you can see the span and it is increasing system of subspaces, flag, and the difference between the neighbors in this list is just one dimension. So when you make orthonormalization, apply Gram-Schmidt process, the flag does not change. Therefore, all the achievements that we had without inner product extend to the situation when we have inner product, provided that it was used, that this technology with flag could be used. In particular, we had a theorem according to which any linear operator for any linear operator there exists a basis with respect to which it is upper triangle, it is represented by upper triangular matrix. Do you remember this? It was quite a while ago. And now what we can do, we can just get the following consequence for free. It is called Schur theorem. In the textbook, it has number 638, and it says that any operator in the product space V has orthonormal basis with respect to which it is represented by upper triangular matrix. So for any operator, there exists orthonormal basis such that T is upper triangular with respect to this basis. It is useful sometimes, as it was useful the original theorem. See, it has a name before it has no. What is also very important and useful, and you may see this, probably you have seen already this, since you had to probably solve the homework, is the following theorem, which also has a name. It is called Ries representation theorem. And it says the following, that for any linear functional, any element of the space dual to in the product space, so we have an in the product space V, we take covector, so the vector from the dual space, there exists an unique vector in V such that the values of our functional on whatever vector can be presented as the inner product of V and U.
Is that Ries like German for giant?
It is Ries. I don't know if German enough to say that this is giant, maybe. I thought he was Hungarian, but it doesn't matter. Probably the name was German.
I guess I'll look that up later.
But anyway, I think that the spelling is accurate. And this statement in the textbook has number 642. And the proof is, well, quite obvious. Let us consider, so given our functional, it is nothing but a function on V, linear function on V. So let us consider its value on some vector V. Okay. I can represent this vector as linear combination of my basis. So let us choose whatever orthonormal basis, E1, etc., EN. And then we can expand V as a linear combination of vectors from this basis. And what is excellent feature of orthonormal basis, it allows us to write formula. The coefficients can be expressed just as products of this V by our basis vectors. So this is the standard representation of any vector as a linear combination of the basis vectors from orthonormal basis. Then we can plug in this representation into our formula for phi of V, and we get that this is phi of the sum from 1 to n V E I times E I, right? And now we can use the fact that phi is linear. So we can change the order between phi and the sum and the coefficient. So we will get the sum again from 1 to n, the inner products, and then phi of EI, right? Okay, and now look, we have inner product. So in each sum, and we have inner product times some element of our ground field. So we can move it inside. We can write down that this is the sum from 1 to n of inner product of V with phi of EI. Okay, it should be conjugate because this is second argument, times EI. I have no space. Let me add more space. Okay. And I continue. And now I use additivity along the second argument, which is absolutely legal here by of the properties that we studied before. Oh, sorry. It should be V sum. And here we have phi of EI bar conjugate EI. So look, it is represented as a product of inner product of V by some vector. The vector is obtained explicitly. So this is our dream vector U. We wanted to have it and we got it. So we can take for U this vector. I E I bar E I. The proof is done. Oh, no, 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 not yet. There was one more thing to prove. There is a little sign here. Exclamation sign. I don't remember if I used this notation before. It means that this U is unique. It is uniqueness. There exists U, and this U is unique. And I have to prove this as well. So how to prove this? Well, assume that there are many, say we have U1 and U2. And both of them have this property that phi of V equals V times UI for whatever I, one and two. Then we can take these two formulas and subtract one from the other one. And what you get is that zero equals the product of V and U1 minus U2. So what does it mean? It means that the difference U1 and U2 is orthogonal to V. And this is for any V. And when we have such a thing, it means that this is zero. Only zero vector is orthogonal to everybody. This is one of the axioms for inner product. Okay?
What's O and L here?
O and O and B, I will denote in this way orthonormal basis.
Oh, no.
It's too long to write orthonormal basis. But now the Riesz representation theorem is proven. And if you have any questions, it's a good time to ask.
Does this work in the other direction? If we have a function, there's one vector that works for the dot product. But if we have one vector, is there only one function?
Yes, of course, because it is given by this formula. Look, we wanted to get a vector such that in the product by it is this functional. And this is for all V. Functional is nothing but a function, really. It has extra property, it should be linear, but it is determined by its values. So this is correct. But it's too little in comparison to the other direction. So it is what is, this is formulated in that way. I hear some question or just conversation. Do you want to ask something? No? Okay. Now the next notion that we have to consider is the notion of orthogonal complement. What is going on? Definition. So we have the pen doesn't work. It's charged. So assume that we have in the product space V and some subset in it. Then its orthogonal complement is the set of all vectors which are orthogonal to all vectors in U. Okay. Hope that my pen now it works. So we have this space V. It's subset, just subset, not necessarily subspace. U and then U orthogonal is denoted in this way, is the set of all vectors from V such that in the product of this vector V and U equals zero for any U in U capital. Okay. I hear some conversation. Probably I have to mute you. Okay. Now, this notion is probably somehow known to you. The definition is given in the textbook in with number 645. And it has numerous properties which are very obvious, very easy. First of all, this orthogonal complement is a subspace, vector subspace, so it is a vector space in particular, no matter what was U. U may be not a subspace, but its orthogonal complement is anyway a subspace. And it is clear because what you can do, first of all, if you have two vectors, V and W, from this orthogonal complement, then the sum also is from orthogonal complement, because if V and W is orthogonal to some vector, then the sum also is orthogonal, just by definition of orthogonality. Definition of orthogonality, let me remind you, says that the inner product is equal to zero. So I have to check that V plus W dot product with U is zero, provided V and W have this property. But this is the sum of two dot products by linearity, by additivity of dot product. Then since we assume that V and W belong to the orthogonal complement, this is zero and that is zero, and therefore the sum is zero, and that's it. Then what is orthogonal complement to the zero subspace? Tell me, please.
Would it be the whole space?
Just the space itself.
Of course, because everybody is orthogonal to the zero. On the other hand, the orthogonal complement of the whole space is zero because of the axiom. Now, if you take any subspace, any subset really, and this orthogonal complement, the intersection is not large. It may be at most this zero. Well, if it is zero, if and only if U is a subspace. No. No, 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 no. No, not if and only if. But if U is a subspace, it must, U must have a zero, and then the intersection is like that. Now, this operation, taking orthogonal complement, is, how to say it, anti-monotone. What does it mean? That if you have two subspaces, two subsets, U and W, and U is contained in W, then for the orthogonal complements, you have the opposite inclusion. Right? You have to think why. Well, what should I say? What should I prove? I should prove that this is contained there. So let me take whatever V from W orthogonal. It is known that it is orthogonal to each element of W, but all elements in U belong to W. So V orthogonal to all of them, and we are done. Oh, not this fast. Okay. Any question? Then let's go further. What is called 647? If you is a subspace, then V is the orthogonal sum of U and its orthogonal complement. So each subspace has is a direct summand of the whole space, and one of the summands which gives, together with U, the whole V, is its orthogonal complement. Of course, there are many other summands. Imagine that on the plane we have this U. Then, of course, the whole plane is the sum of U, orthogonal, direct sum of U and U orthogonal. But also you can take W like this, skew, and the direct sum of U and W will be still the whole space, okay? But this is a beta sum. It has sometimes a special name. We used for this notion so far the term direct sum, it's the sum of spaces such that elements of different spaces are independent always. Of course, it happens when the spaces are orthogonal to each other, and then this sum can be praised by saying that it is orthogonal sum. But I think that in Axler, this term is not used. Anyway, you have to be aware about this. What about the dimensions? Of course, since V is the direct sum of U and its orthogonal complement, the dimension of V is the sum of these two dimensions, as always when we have a direct sum. So we have this formula. And therefore, the dimension of the orthogonal complement can be calculated as the difference, the dimension of V minus dimension of U. So it's easy. And this easy consequence has a name, it is called 650. The next property of orthogonal complement, it is involutory operation. If U is a subspace, of course, then double orthogonal complement is the original subspace. It's again, though there are some arguments about that. Let me present it. So what does it mean? First of all, it is easy to see that U is contained in the double orthogonal complement, right? And this is on the verbal level very easy. What does it mean? It means that each element of U is orthogonal to each element of the orthogonal complement of U. But orthogonal complement of U is the set of all vectors which are orthogonal to U. And we are done, at least for this inclusion. Should I repeat? I want to prove that U is contained in this double orthogonal complement. Let us take a vector from U. Is it orthogonal to each element from the orthogonal complement? Yes, because of the definition of orthogonal complement. Now, this is enough together with this formula. So we see that U is contained in that space, but they have the same dimensions. U is a subspace, it has some dimension. Then the orthogonal complement of U, say if V has dimension N and U has dimension K, then the orthogonal complement to U has dimension N minus K. And the orthogonal complement to the orthogonal complement has dimension N minus N minus K, which is K. So the dimensions of these two spaces are the same. And one of them is contained in the other one. This may happen only if the spaces coincide. If one space is contained in the other and the dimensions coincide, then we have an equality. This is, by the way, quite interesting and powerful argument. Try to prove the same thing without it. Then what you need to do, you need to have, you consider some vector from here and prove that it belongs to you. Without this argument, it may be quite non-trivial. At least not straightforward. Now, the next notion. So we are still in a geometry of inner product space. The geometry of inner product space is quite rich because it has this structure in the product. So in particular, for each subspace, now that we have a subspace of U, there is a linear map from V to U, which is called orthogonal projection. Oh, no, sorry. I said the wrong thing. Let me improve. So there is a map from V to V. It is an operator, of course. It is a linear operator in V. And it is called projector onto U. And it can be defined as follows. For each vector V from V, V can be presented as a sum of U and W, where U belongs to this subspace, and W belongs to its orthogonal complement. Why is it so? Because we have the splitting. V is a direct sum of U and the orthogonal. So this means that at least it is a sum. And the fact that this is a direct sum means that this representation is unique. And now we define P U of V to be U. Just like that. So this is a definition of PU. And it is called orthogonal projection or projector denoted like this, PU. Well, I'm not stable in writing U capital. Sometimes I write it in a printing way like this. Sometimes like that. Sorry. This should be at least the same thing. I have to be consistent with this. And this is a very important thing, projector. So it is so important that we have to consider the properties of it. By the way, the definition has also a number. It is 651. And now we are in 655, which is the set of properties of projectors. So first property, I already sort of have written it. The projector is an operator in my space. What does it mean?
It's a linear map?
Yes, this is a linear map. So it should be checked that it is additive and homogeneous. Say if we have V1 and V2, then PU of V1 plus V2 should be PU of V1 plus PU of V2. And so to prove this, we need to use definition. Okay, so for V1, we have some representation like this, U1 plus W1, where U1 belongs to U and W1 belongs to the orthogonal complement. Similarly to V2, so let me just write here I and write that I is 1 or 2. And then we sum up this and we get that Y1, V1 plus V2 equals U1 plus U2 plus W1 plus W2. Since U is a linear space, a vector space, the sum belongs to U. And since the orthogonal complement also is a vector space, the sum belongs to W, to the orthogonal complement, And this means that PU of V1 plus V2 is equal to U1 plus U2. Uniqueness solves the problem, so we shouldn't worry about this. That if we choose some other representative of V1 plus V2, well, not other, but other splitting. There is only one splitting, so uniquely defined. And similarly, you can prove that PU of lambda U, lambda V, sorry, lambda V is as it should be, like that. I leave it to your consideration. Now, what happens if the argument belongs to U? Then PU of V is just the same V. So in other words, PU restricted to U is identity of U, right? Well, if we take a vector belonging to U, then it's decomposition into vector in U and vector perpendicular to U looks like U plus zero. And we just ignore this zero to get PU of V. And on the other hand, PU restricted to the orthogonal complement is zero. So also this. So the range of PU is U. The null space of PU is orthogonal. So V minus its image is orthogonal to U. So it is belonging to the orthogonal complement. Another very characteristic property of a projector is that it is idempotent. This word means that its square coincides with itself. So P squared equals P. Sometimes people think that a projector is just characterized by this property. But then they have no right to say that this is orthogonal projector. There is a general feeling, what is projector? Say, for example, you take something and project to the plane, some figure in the space. What does it mean? Well, you may project differently. The simplest way, which is studied in geometric, how is it called in English? Constructive geometry. So drawing, technical drawing, it is orthogonal projection. But you can project anything also along any direction. Or even from a point to a plane. These are all different maps, but they share one common property. They are idempotent. If you start with a figure which is already on the plane and project it to this plane, no matter how you project it, it will be still the same. The map is identical. But probably in mathematics, the word idempotent is preferable. to the name of projector. Item potent map is projector. Okay. Now, what else? The norm of image of a vector under projection is not greater than the vector itself. And this follows from the Pythagoras theorem. Because V is the sum of U and W, where this U belongs to U and W belongs to U orthogonal. So we are in the situation when Pythagoras theorem can be applied, and then we see that the norm V squared is the norm of U squared plus the norm of W squared. And therefore, it is greater or equal than the norm of U squared. Now take the square roots and you get this projection. Remember that this is nothing but the projection onto the space U of vector V. So we have that the square of this inequality. We are done. Am I too fast or too slow? Complain.
It was okay.
Okay.
That's good.
Thank you. Now, there are various formulas for projectors. The simplest formula is when you have one-dimensional subspace, and it is generated by whatever vector, vector U or W. U is span of W, and this is capital U. And then projection of vector V onto this space can be calculated as follows. You just take V W divided by W squared and multiply by W. Should I explain this? Probably you had this formula somewhere in the preceding course of linear algebra. But anyway, how to prove this? Well, does it belong to you? Yes, it does, because W belongs to you, right? And this is just a coefficient. What about the difference between this vector and V? V minus this vector. Is it orthogonal to U? Well, how to check if it is orthogonal to U or not? You just need to multiply this by W. And what will be the result? For the first, you have just, open brackets. VW minus, VW divided by W squared and multiplied by W squared. So this cancel out and you get zero. So it is orthogonal and that's it. So this is a projector. Now, in general, formulas are more sophisticated. Recently, I learned a formula which I didn't know before, how to write down the projector for arbitrary subspace generated by some arbitrary basis. If you are lazy to use Gram-Schmidt beforehand, this formula would work. Otherwise, please go ahead and use Gram-Schmidt. I mean, there is a nice formula which represents, what is going on? Yeah. PU of V for U, which has orthonormal basis, say E1, etc., EK. Then you just project, use the same formula for each of them and sum up. This is the sum of V times EI divided by, well, no division because the norm of EI is one. It should be one in denominator. So let me skip it because this is orthonormal basis and this is multiplied by EI. So this is a very nice formula. I, of course, should change from 1 to k. K is the dimension of u here. And how to prove this formula? Okay. I have to prove that this formula gives me projector. So let us assume that my v is represented by as a sum of U and W, where U belongs to the, W belongs to its orthogonal complement. I should check that this thing is U. But instead, wait a moment. How did we define? We defined it exactly in this way. Mm-hmm. So, okay. First of all, it is clear that it belongs to you. Why it belongs to you? Because it is a linear combination of vectors from U. No problem. U is a subspace, and this is orthonormal basis, no matter if it is orthonormal or not, but it is a basis, so the linear combination must belong to U. Now, what about W? Then W here can be expressed as difference. W is V minus U. So I have to prove that V minus this sum. Okay. Belongs to your orthogonal. So it should be orthogonal to any vector there. Well, I don't want to multiply it by any vector. It's enough to check that it is orthogonal to each EJ, each of these basis vectors, right? And then I just multiply by EJ. V minus this linear combination. and I multiply it by EJ, and I have to prove that it is zero. I have to prove that they are orthogonal. It's easy. It is V times EJ minus the product of this sum to this EJ. V times EI, EI, EJ. But EI times EJ is delta IJ. So the result is like this, minus V times EJ, and this is zero. I have checked this formula. Geometrically, what does it mean? Really, each element in this sum, each term in this sum, is a projection of my vector v to the corresponding line, to the coordinate line in u. So in this u, so imagine that this u is a plane in the three space. So I have a basis e1, e2 here. I have this line and that line, and I have whatever vector here. I want to project this vector to the plane. What am I doing? I'm projecting it to the lines, to the coordinate lines. And then the sum of projections is the required projection. This is this I shouldn't prove, it is just what is given by that formula. We know already that each sum is a projection to a line. And then we have checked that the sum of the summons is a projection on the subspace U. And we see now that this projection to the subspace is the sum of projections. Now, projection is nice because it sometimes minimizes distances. This is a method of the statement which has the number 6 by 6 in the textbook. So, what is this? We have a space V. In this space V, we have a subspace U. Let us take an arbitrary vector from V and some vector from U, also arbitrary. And then so what is happening? I have here 0, this is U. This is my vector V. And this is some vector U small from U capital. We have also projection of V to U, P, U, V, this one. What is claimed is that the distance between V and this projection, and this distance is the norm of difference. So where is this V minus P U V? Here it is. V minus P U V. So I claim that this thing is closer to V than any other point. Probably I should formulate this in another way. I do not need to introduce U from the very beginning. I could say the same thing mathematically, the same thing, but in the following way. Take any subspace U and vector in the space. Project this vector. The distance between V and its projection is not greater than distance between V and any other point in the subspace U. So the projection is the closest point to V, which is, I guess, is quite makes sense. It corresponds to your experience and probably to some theorems that you studied at school. So when you want to find the closest approximation of your vector with the restriction that this approximation should belong to your subspace, the problem is just to find the projection. Of course, the distance should be defined in terms of your inner product, so everything should be consistent. Now, as for the proof is easy. Let us take this norm of V minus PUV. Squared. Then on the other hand, we have when I want to prove some inequality between norms, I will end up with proving inequality between the squares, because they are defined in terms of squares. So what is the difference between these two things? Can we insert anything? Oh, of course. Take a look at this picture. So what is V minus U? It is this vector, right? This is V minus U. You have to connect V and U. And on the other hand, V minus PUV is here. And we can complete these two vectors by the third one so that it would be a right triangle here. Why it is a right triangle? Because any vector in U is orthogonal to this V minus PUV. So this angle is right. So then we can use Pythagoras' theorem. So this is hypotenuse, this is side, and this PUV minus U, or vice versa, squared should be equal to that. And then we, if we skip this summand, then we will get that the square of V minus U is greater or equal than the square of V minus PUV squared. And this is what we had to prove, right? Are you with me? Hey, is it good? Okay. And this is the end of the chapter. The next chapter has number 7, as you could guess. And this is about more advanced stuff. We will consider now operators in the product space. This is the title of this chapter. And we start with a definition. consider any linear map from vector space V to vector space W. But now they are not just vector spaces, they are in product spaces, both U and V, W. V and W. V and W. Oh. In this situation, there is another operator which acts in the opposite direction from W to V, and it is called a joint operator, a joint of T. It is defined by a simple property. However, the fact that it is defined by this property is a matter of proof. I have to prove this. So what is the property? The property is the following. It is just the formula. For any two vectors, V from V capital and W from W capital, the inner product of TV and W, and I have to notice that this inner product is happening in W, that this inner product in W is equal to V, the inner product of V and T star W. And this happens where these vectors are, that is in V. So in this formula, everything is defined by the assumptions besides one term, T star W. So this is a definition which requires a proof. It's funny how it is said, how the textbook says about this. We have to check that this definition makes sense. Yes, we have to prove that this definition really defines something. What does it mean? It means that for any data, V, W, T, all these inner products, there exist and unique the vector T star W, which satisfies this equality, right? This is what I define, T star W. I have to prove that this thing really exists and is unique. Okay, how to prove this? Do I have time? Yeah. So first let us take a look on the left-hand side of this equality. It should be, so I have to fix for a while W and consider V as a variable. Then we have a map which assigns to each value of V that number, the inner product of TV and W. And this is a linear functional. Why? Because T is linear map, and the inner product is linear on first variable. So overall, this is linear functional. So in other words, it belongs to V dual. Okay, so let me denote it by phi for a while. And then I have this, we have this theorem by Ries, Ries representation theorem. So we have this functional, and by Ries representation theorem, there exists unique U in V such that functional phi of V can be presented as the inner product of V by U. Exactly, Ries representation theorem. And we just denote this U by T star W. So it is uniquely defined. And now it seems that my time is almost over. There is something else that I have to prove here. And of course, this is also proved in Axler. But I will do this next time. So what should I prove in this definition? Just to make sense. I have to prove that this construction really gives me linear map. The T star is linear. It's not just a map. It should be additive, homogeneous, and blah, blah, blah. So, and then we have to consider various properties of a joint operator, how this construction. I want to you, I want to give you one more a question to think about. We had already a similar construction. When we started dual space, there was a notion of a map dual to a given map. To check, we denoted it by T check. And the definition was very similar. It used, though, instead of inner product, this bracket, Dirac bracket, the duality. I want you to think about this similarity and try to answer to the following question. What is the relation between these two notions? Is it possible to obtain one of them from the other one? It is not included into your homework. It is just for your development, maybe more useful than homework. We will think a little bit about that, and we will discuss this next time. For me, it is not an easy problem. I have to think about this on my own. And that's all for today. So I will have office hours today at 5:30. Last time it was some problem, technical problem. Come here through Blackboard and get to Zoom to my office hours. I hope that it will work. If not, let me know immediately if you will try to do this and will fail. Let me know immediately by email. I do not insist that you would come. Of course, you are welcome. I don't mean to make another obligatory lecture. But if you will come, please be insistent. Thank you. That's all for today.